patches of fog, and expect a strong possibility of light rain throughout the day. Sunday's high, 48 in the Kenosha-Racine area, 45 in Walworth County. Right now, sunshine, temperature reading of 10. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show.
We take a look today at one of the monumental moments in sports history. And some would say, one of the monumental moments in human history. It is a day which occurred about 50 years ago in England when the first four-minute mile was run by Roger Bannister. The story of that tremendous moment, that tremendous achievement, and all that led up to it, and some of what occurred after it, is told so beautifully in a book called The Perfect Mile. Three athletes, one goal, and less than 4 minutes to achieve it, by Neil Bascom. This superb book is published by Houghton Mifflin, and I'm very grateful that we have Neil Bascom with us for a few minutes to talk about this very interesting and inspiring story. Neil Bascom, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I was reading your book in the shower the other day. Believe it or not, that's where I read a lot of the books for this job. And so I don't have the dust jacket anymore, and so I don't have your biography anymore. And just a real quick question. Do you come at this story with any personal interest or experience in track and field, in running? Because you certainly seem to write perceptively about the many challenges that face these kind of athletes.
Well, I was certainly no four-minute miler, but I ran actually cross country in high school, and I had read Roger Bannister's story at that age, and just was very much inspired by it. So. I found that as I became a writer, it was one of those stories that I always wanted to write about, and here we are.
You tell the story, actually, not only of Roger Bannister, but of two other runners that were very actively engaged with him, one an Australian, one an American, all very much in contention to be the first man to break this sort of mythical mark of the four-minute mile. How much did you know about the other two runners before you began investigating this story in earnest?
Well, I thought that this story would be primarily about Roger Bannister. I had known the name Wes Nanty, the American miler, and John Landy, the Australian, and knew that at this time that they were trying to break the four-minute mile as well. But I didn't quite understand the scope of this story and the scope of the race and how much each athlete pushed the other to achieve. And so ultimately, I found after 3 or 4 months of research, having met with each of them and talked with them over several days, that it really was the story about three men, and it really was a race. And so the only way to understand why Roger Bannister was able to break the four-minute mile was to understand how Wes Nanty and John Landy went about their goal as well.
Mm. This is, as you say, a story about a lot of different things. One of them is that we are talking about a certain kind of athlete, particularly in the case of Roger Bannister, someone that we might call a gentleman amateur. Tell us a bit more about what this kind of athlete really represented, and maybe to what extent Wes Santee and John Landy were also gentlemen amateurs.
Sure. I mean, the early 1950s was a pivotal moment in sport. It was really a watershed moment. It was the time when the amateur athlete, the gentleman amateur, was on its way out, and the professional was really the only way to be the best in the world. You had to train many hours a day. The amateur athlete's role was saw sports as a passionate hobby. Most famous story is the great story of Bevel Rudd, a sprinter who showed up at the track with a cigar in his mouth, laid it down, finished his sprint race, came back and picked the cigar back up. This was the sort of gentleman amateur, the idea of effortless superiority, that sport should not dominate one's life, that it should be part of a very large life. And so there you have Roger Bannister, who only trained a half hour a day to an hour a day. He was in the midst of his medical school studies during his pursuit of the 4-minute mile, and kept a very robust life outside of that, as well as acting. So he really typified the gentleman amateur. Wes Santee was really on the line. He was, he trained 3 or 4 hours a day. He had a coach. He was funded basically by his scholarship at the University of Kansas. That's not to say that he made any money off his pursuit of athletics. So, but he was really on the edge of the amateur to the professional. And John Landy, much like Roger Bannister, typified the gentleman amateur. He in no way saw sport as a career. He knew that the time he turned 25, that was going to be it for him, and that he needed to pursue life outside of running the mile.
We're speaking with Neil Bascom about his book called The Perfect Mile, 3 athletes, 1 goal in less than 4 minutes to achieve it. One of the things that's interesting about this book and about these 3 athletes is also the story of how they worked towards this incredible goal, and who was in their inner circle helping them to achieve what they did. One of the interesting stories here is of Roger Bannister, who for most of his active competitive life really had no coach in the purest sense of the word. He was of these 3, certainly what we would call an athletic loner, although ultimately he ended up achieving this not alone at all.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting about Roger Bannister. I mean, when this story really sets out in 1952 after these 3 athletes fail in Helsinki, it's quite sort of simple to identify them. Santee ran out of heart and emotion. Landy ran out of will and determination, and Roger Bannister ran from his head. He had intellectualized sport. But what you found as the race progressed and as Bannister came closer and closer and continued to fail is that he's the one who made the greatest character arc, as it were. He began to understand that he couldn't do it alone, that this lone wolf approach of not running with other people in training, not taking on a coach, was never going to get him to the point where he was able to break the 4-minute mile. So he learned from his coach, Franz Stampel, who he took on in late 1953, only about 5 months before he broke the 4-minute mile. He learned from him about will and determination. He, as Franz Stampel most famously said, his goal as a coach was to get his athlete to push past the point where he thought he was going to die. And it's a fabulous statement, but that really, you know, that emboldened Roger Bannister. That made him understand that will and determination had something to do with it.
Right. The Australian John Landy, for a while, not at the time that he broke broke through that 4-minute barrier eventually, but for much of his time as he really rose in the ranks, had a very offbeat coach who had a very, very, very odd approach to guiding his athletes. Tell us a little bit about him, his approach, and what difference that ultimately made for John Landy in ultimately achieving this goal.
Well, his coach's name was Percy Saraty, particularly in his early stages of John Landy's running career. And Percy Saraty was best way to put it, is a bit of a lunatic at first, but he also had a tremendous motivating force on his athletes. Now, Saraty taught a number of very odd things. He had his athletes running through knee-deep surf. He had them yoga and keeping a diet strictly of oats, teaching them Plato and various other things, all of which were sort of out there. But what he was able to achieve with John Landy, as Landy told me, is that he was able to pull the discipline out of John. He was able to have him realize that he could achieve if he trained hard enough. And so that was the greatest lesson for Landy, and that carried through this whole race. I mean, nobody trained harder than Landy.
Right.
He always wanted to be the fittest person on the track.
Serity had a couple of interesting ideas. One of them, I thought, was in asking his athletes at one point to run through botanical gardens carrying bamboo poles in each arm. He wanted them to run like primitive men. To strip away some of what he maybe believed modernity was robbing from their essential abilities to run. But he also had this idea about the athlete being a Stoaton, part Stoic, part Spartan. What did he mean by that?
Well, he wanted running to be people's whole life. He had an understanding that in order to achieve great things, you needed to sacrifice a great deal. And so we came up with this whole idea of the Stoaton philosophy, and running as the dominant force in your life. But you know, there were all kinds of things that the Percy Serity taught. He had his runners also run like roosters at times. He prophylactized that you don't need to warm up. And he showed that by pouring a jug of water over a cat, and the cat bursts away and says, look, the cat doesn't need to warm up. So he had all these ideas, and he was testing his ideas out on his athletes, and the Stoaton philosophy was wrapped up in all that. So he had his athletes come out to his camp up on the beach, and they would stay there night after night and have lectures and then run all day, and it was a camp.
Mm. And you say at one point by the 10th day of that camp, that gang of runners had bonded. They were both exhausted and inspired. I have a feeling you have to run track and know what that discipline is like, and what a grueling discipline it is, to understand that state of being both exhausted and inspired.
Yes, I mean, they had reached a feeling of that their bodies could achieve a great deal more than they had ever sought out before. Mm. And particularly in Australia back then, where distance runners were considered absolute lunatics, and why would you even attempt to do something? So there was this overwhelming idea that it was actually unhealthy to train this much. And Percy Serity, his great influence was to show that that was quite different case. And he was a man in his mid-50s running marathons and ultra-marathons at a time when no one did that.
Hmm. The third athlete which you explore, this was a new name to me. I certainly knew the name of Roger Bannister and John Landy very well. But I had not heard, I'm embarrassed to say, of this brilliantly talented runner from Kansas by the name of Wes Santee. And what an inspiring story he has. I mean, in many respects, the most inspiring story of these three athletes, particularly when we think about the kind of home life which he had. He is fortunate, we are all fortunate, that he ever became a runner at all. Explain a little bit about this side of the Santee story.
Yes, well, I mean, this is one of the most touching points of the story that I wrote about. I mean, Wes Santee came from a small town in Ashland, Kansas, and his father was rather brutal. Abuse kept him on the farm, would not allow him at times to go to school in order that he'd work hour after hour on the farm. As I said, that he was one of those rare fathers who don't want better for their sons than they had themselves. And so Wes's father kept him from running and refused to allow him to race at a very young age. When Santee, the only time he felt good about himself was when he was actually running and racing. And eventually, Santee was so good and so determined to be a great miler that he escaped from Ashland, Kansas, and went on to the University of Kansas. And really took on, Bill Easton, the coach there, really took on the role as father to him.
It was a
very nice moment.
Absolutely. We should actually, I think, mention his high school coach as well, because I think it really underscores the critical difference which one determined individual can make. And in this case, we're talking about Santee's high school coach at one point, in a very critical way, standing up to Wes Santee's father. Or it's certainly possible that that young man's running career could have ended before he ever entertained a thought of going off to college. Tell us about that inspiring moment as well.
Well, his coach, a man named Mr. Murray, came over to the Santee farm, and there's virtually no one allowed at on the farm at this point, no strangers. And he comes up and walks into the living room and tells Wes's father that his son Wes should be running, and that he needs, you know, this is a great opportunity for him, and that he's not going to take no for an answer. And it turns out that actually Wes has to sneak out away from the farm that next morning to run in a race. And when Wes comes back, his father keeps him on the farm for 24 hours plowing the field. And Murray hears of this and calls Santee's father and says, "Listen, it's never going to happen again. I want you to deliver Wes by truck to school and to all his races," and didn't allow him to say no. And from that point on, it was basically a point where Murray stood up to the bully that was Wes's father. And that made the world of difference in Wes's life.
We're speaking with Neil Bascom, and his book is called The Perfect Mile. As someone who never has run track or even entertained the thought, I think one of the things I really found especially fascinating about your book is that you really reveal to us what this life is like, and particularly for very gifted and incredibly committed track and field athletes, what is going on in the training process. I think those of us that just drive in our cars and occasionally see somebody running along the side of the road in track practice, it looks, you know, almost laughably simple and basic on the outside, and of course it isn't at all. And in particular this particular event, the mile, presents certain really special challenges and problems. Tell us some of the really interesting details which you are able to uncover in the way in which these three athletes in particular were training towards this great goal.
Well, for instance, John Landy would, at 11 o'clock every night, he would sneak out of his house not to wake his family and cross the road very, you know, not able to even see the ground underneath him, would run round and round a track every night. And just, I think the key for him was he wanted to push his body just a little bit further each night. And that's the sort of love that he got out of running, was testing his body, was pushing to see how far he could stretch his discipline and determination.
I love at one point when you point out that he typically would run without a watch, I guess unlike other track athletes. He said his effort was measured by the interplay of exhaustion and recovery.
Yeah.
He developed a real sense of knowing just how well he was doing, just how fast he was going, just by sensing how his body felt.
Yeah, I mean, he had a 600-yard grass track, and he would run barefoot, and he would run a 600-yard lap, and then slow down, I mean, heavy with breath, and then just at that point where he began to feel like he had recovered, he went another 600 yards, and then he would just do this over and over and over again. And he remembers waking up in the morning, walking to the train station to go to the university, and barely being able to walk. And since no one knew why he was training so much, they said, "Well, why are you walking so slow?" And they had no idea that night of the torture that he was putting his body under.
Hmm. One matter which complicates the situation for Wes Santee once he is in college is that he is expected by his coach, and I suppose rightly so, to be a full participant on the track team, which often meant running the last leg of some relay race in which his team was already hopelessly behind, and Santee was not able to focus his energies towards this goal of the four-minute mile the way that Bannister and Landy, for instance, were able to. Difficult thing.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, Santee almost could never run fast enough for all the obstacles that were being put in his place. You know, he did did have his commitment to the University of Kansas Jayhawks. He was running in four races every weekend. And then you have the fact that that he had a number of scholarship responsibilities. And then the interference from amateur officials who were threatened by the fact that, that Wes Santee, the most popular, one of the most popular athletes in the country, was gaining so much power, and amateur officials felt threatened by that. So they got in his way of the pursuit of the four-minute mile. So it's really a touching and at times heartbreaking story that, that Wes Santee faced.
It really is. Is it the 1952 Olympics where AAU officials forbid him essentially from entering what would be his best race? He had already qualified for the 5,000 meters, but his best race and the closest to the mile, of course, was the 1,500 meters. And at the last minute, these meddling officials decided that Wes Santee was not an accomplished enough athlete to be worrying about two different events. So they pulled him from what would have assuredly been his best event. I mean, how maddening for him and all who cared about him to have these officials ruining the situation in the way that they did.
Oh, I mean, so true. I mean, he was the fastest 1,500-meter miler in the country at the time and literally was at the starting line waiting for the time trial to participate in the 1,500 meters, and two officials grabbed him by the arm and pulled him off the track.
Mm. You tell us that Roger Bannister at some point realized that in order to really achieve this, he was going to need what he called, or you call in the book, two pacemakers, not in the standard way that we use that term now, but two other runners in the race who could assist him. Explain very briefly what pacemakers would do in a race like this.
Well, they were the rabbits. They were the runners that that kept Bannister on pace through the first three laps. I mean, it's very difficult running the mile, and Bannister was the best, fastest mile in the country. It's very difficult to run a very fast mile from the front throughout a race. And so what he had was his two friends, Chris Chataway and Chris Brasher, who Brasher would take him through the first two laps. He would lead, and Bannister would hang back a few feet. And then Chataway would take over the third lap. But that final, most critical, fourth lap, Bannister would have to take on his own. But he would have been helped through those first three laps by his rabbit. And this was, you know, this was not a unique event. I mean, many of the world records prior to that had been run with pacemakers, and even today they still do that.
Although you point out at some point in the book that when it first came to light that Roger Bannister had attempted the four-minute mile using other runners in the race this way, it stirred up a bit of controversy and displeasure, if I remember correctly.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, even Bannister, the day after he breaks the four-minute mile and is out celebrating, he understands that the real race, his goal has to be won in a race against another person. It has to be a real competition. And that, you know, yes, he's a great clock runner, as some of the press criticized him, but could he beat the best in head-to-head competition? And that was why the race 3 months after he breaks the four-minute mile against John Landy at the Mile of the Century in Vancouver was the ultimate test, and is actually the reason for the title of the book.
Hmm. This book reads like a suspense thriller, I suppose, for someone who might not know how this story ultimately ends. I think most of us know that the man of these three who was finally able to break through that barrier first was indeed the Englishman, Roger Bannister. And but it is it is so suspenseful. And we realize that had just details here and there worked out just a little bit differently, even things as seemingly trivial as the weather could have made a difference, and one of the other two athletes so easily could have been the first to break the barrier.
I mean, what's so interesting about this story is that when I had met these three men, and they were such different personalities, and they had different backgrounds, different racing tactics, different approaches to coaches, that I actually found myself rooting for each of them in each of these races prior to May 6th, and hoping that, though I knew that wasn't the case, hoping that this would be the race for John Landy, and finding that the wind was blowing too hard that day, or for Wes Santee, and then the rain comes down and just, you know, ruins the track. And so it made it sort of easy to write these scenes, and I'm wanted each of them to do it because they each had their own reasons for doing it.
We should mention that John Landy does also break the four-minute mile, and he and Bannister confront one another in a very dramatic race, and they both break the four-minute mile in that race, Bannister for the second time, and Bannister wins the race. It's a thrilling, thrilling confrontation. For Wes Santee, he whittles it down to tenths of a second above 4 minutes, but never is able to quite break down into the magic 3 minutes and however many seconds. That is a barrier he is just unable to crack.
Yeah, 5 tenths of a second is what separated Wes Santee from being the first American to break 4 minutes. And 5 tenths of a second is nothing. It's a little faster start. It's the wind blowing a little bit better. It's the track being slightly faster. Again, he was so close, but he never did it.
We should mention that this was one of the ancillary stories you tell is of the press, in particular the British press, and the way that they followed this story with breathless excitement, but in a way that could border on the brutal, in the way that they would castigate Roger Bannister for his failures or what they saw as bewildering choices on his part. I mean, the press did not make any of this easier.
No, they crucified him on a number of different occasions, particularly after the 1952 Olympics, where Bannister was slated to win the 1500 meters. He was the last great hope of Britain taking home a gold medal, and he failed. And they just, you know, they said, great, he can run past trees very fast, but can he win in head-to-head competition? Again, that whole thing about is he a clock runner or is he a competitor? And, you know, much of his ambition and focus for redemption came from, at start, the press, who were so brutal to him, and then the public followed. And he wanted a way to redeem himself, and by doing the Everest of sport, he was able to do it.
Mm. Well, the story of Roger Bannister in the end becomes so inspiring, but all three stories are tremendously inspiring. And I think they all deserve the words of praise which were afforded to Roger Bannister when he was honored with England's Sportsman of the Year Award. And he was told in the presentation, "It is given to very few people to do something in this world which will be forever remembered. That is what you have done." And thanks to your book, all three of these great athletes, with their great effort, have done something which will always be remembered.
Well, I mean, this was a wonderful book to write because I think, you know, John Landy and Wes Santee deserves as much acclaim as Roger Bannister. And I think personally that the lessons that can be won from them as well as Bannister are just as important.
The book is The Perfect Mile, Three Athletes, One Goal, and Less Than 4 Minutes to Achieve It, published by Houghton Mifflin and written by Neil Bascom. Neil Bascom, I congratulate you on a superb book. I loved every page, and I really enjoyed speaking with you about it on the morning show today. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
As it turns out, I enjoyed this interview with Neil Bascom so much that for one of the first times in my career here at WGTD, I actually reached out to him to ask if I could follow up with a few more questions, and to that he graciously agreed. So here is part two of my conversation with Neil Bascom, the author of The Perfect Mile.
One of the things which I think is especially helpful about your book is that we are getting a sense of the mile as a very special kind of running challenge and running event. And I think most of us just blithely assume that for all time there's been something called the mile. And you give us a history lesson of the mile all the way back to that point in history when someone first designated a length of distance as a mile. Tell us just a little bit about the history of the mile and what is helpful for us in understanding it.
Sure. I mean, it has a very long storied history. I mean, a mile came about from the Romans, Roman soldiers. And my pronunciation may brutalize, but mil passus, which was 1,000 paces by Roman soldiers. And so the Romans marked roads all over Europe by these what became mile markers. And so the first runners actually to run the mile were footmen who ran alongside the coaches of their masters and began betting one another could go from one road marker to the next in the fastest amount of time, and actually their bosses would bet on who would be the first person to do it. Hmm. And so then it came to England as well, because the Romans obviously were there, and then they designated an exact distance for the mile, basically in the early 1800s. And then it became a professional race, long before amateurs or Olympics or anything along those lines. It was an event for gambling, and so the best milers at the time were actually professional foot racers.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that one of the reasons why the mile was an especially popular event in these kind of settings was because you could fit a quarter-mile track really nicely around a typical cricket field or football field.
Exactly.
And so it was just a very practical way to run races. And so very quickly, runners interested in making cash in these kind of ventures, it behooved them to specialize in the mile.
That's correct. I mean, it was one of the big betting events, so the best athletes went to the mile. And it just was a curious, constellation of events as far as just the mile fitting in a cricket field, and then timekeeping began to get more and more precise. And so particularly in the mid 1800s, when industrialization was taking over and everything began to it began to be important to time things, and so that transcended business and was popular in sports as well. And so records began to come to fore. And suddenly you have mile records being beat year after year in the 1800s. So as you move forward in the 20th century, it's already one of these great events and looking for the best time possible.
I thought it was interesting that you touch on a moment in the 19th century when a great race was called, was run that was called the Mile of the Century. This is a long time before the races which are really focused on in your book, but this gives us some sense of the importance of this event at this point in time.
Right. I mean, they had the Mile of the Century with a runner named Walter George, who was an amateur who had to turn professional to actually run in this race. And it was, back then, I mean, 10,000 people showed up, which was huge. I mean, it was a huge event played out in London. So even back then, they were heralding these great events.
Tell us about how the thought of a 4-minute mile first sort of slowly emerges on the scene in the 20th century.
Well, as the best milers get quicker and quicker, it began to be buoyed about that 4 minutes, that could be the achievement. But it really wasn't until the 1920s with Paavo Nurmi, who was just a brilliant runner of every distance. And when he, at the Olympics, began to run three events in world record time, a journalist said, well, you know, your next great achievement should be the 4-minute mile. And some people thought that was just ludicrous and insane, and why even prosper something like that? It would be similar today to someone saying the 3-minute mile was quite possible, and Alan Webb, the American miler, would do it very soon. It just was beyond imagination. And so once it began to leak into the popular imagination, and riders began to say, well, this runner could do it and that runner could do it, these great milers began to try to be the first one to do it, but they were 10 seconds away at best.
Right.
At this point. It wasn't until the great milers like Jack Lovelock and Glenn Cunningham, Sidney Woodardson, and Gunder Hag and Arne Andersen, the best milers at their time, and they came in generations, basically, began to slowly edge away or chip away at the mile record to the point where it finally got down to 4:14.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that during the 1930s, especially in the wake of Mr. Nurmi, that as these new milers appear, a new fever sort of sweeps the sport. And you say that in some respects it rivaled boxing in the way that people would pack a place like Madison Square Garden to watch people run around a track.
I mean, it was. I mean, there were these great scenes in the 20s and the 30s where they would literally pack Madison Square Garden. And it was such a much more intimate event back then. It wasn't like today where you have stadiums where you're backed away from the track and you're up in the stands. I mean, the stands literally edged up to the track so that the fans in the front could brush their hands against the milers as they ran by. So there was a feeling as if you were part of the race, and you know, cigar smoke was all over the place, and people were cheering and hollering in a sort of hockey-like atmosphere.
Wow!
And it was you know, great sport.
Hmm. I want to mention the fact that in the prologue of the book, you touch on one of the reasons why the mile, at least at certain points in time, has attracted such attention, and then why in particular this 4-minute mile became such an irresistible goal. I think at one point you talk about the 4-minute mile representing a certain mathematical elegance. Explain that.
Well, it did. I mean, it had this balance to it, this symmetry to it. Four laps of the track under 4 minutes. It had a perfection about it, a mathematical perfection, that I think just attracted people to it. I mean, it almost, as if, as one writer said, it was almost as if God himself had put it as the limit. I mean, as having it so perfectly symmetrical, 4 laps, 4 minutes. It's hard to describe why mathematics, certain mathematical has elegance, but this certainly does.
Right. You also talk about how the mile is different from other races like the 100-yard dash, for instance, or the marathon, in that it kind of requires the best of both disciplines, that you have to be fast to run a good mile, but you also have to have stamina to run a good mile. And that is also sort of an elegant balance.
It is. I mean, you know, when you have with the sprinters, you know, there's only so much you can do with sprinters. I mean, they're naturally gifted, and you're either fast or you're not. And then with endurance, long distance endurance, marathon, it's largely a question of how much you're willing to train and dedicate your life to being the best. But the mile falls absolutely in between those two. It's not only do you have to be at least partially gifted at this level, very gifted speed-wise, you have to have great determination and will as far as running long distances. So it falls in that sweet spot in between, which makes it a wonderful race. And I think the other point is that in a mile race, there is time for offensive and defensive moves. So there is a bit of thrust and parry, but there's only time for one offensive and one defensive move. So there is the guillotine blade is hanging there as well.
We're speaking with Neil Bascom about his book, The Perfect Mile. One of the things you do in your book to set up the drama of 1954 is to take us back a couple of years to the Helsinki Olympics of 1952, and in particular to the disappointment which is tasted there by the three athletes whom you focus on in this book. We've already touched on the fact that Wes Santee was derailed by the meddling of officials that kept him out of what would have been his best event, the 1500 meters. Tell us about the disappointments which were experienced in Helsinki by Roger Bannister and John Landy.
Sure. Well, I think Roger Bannister, of the three, actually was probably the most devastated for having lost at Helsinki because he was expected to win. In 1948, he said, "I'm not ready to run an Olympics," although his country asked him. Said, "No, I want to wait to the 52 Olympics. I want to get myself in the best shape." And so he spent 4 years training and traveling around the world and competing against the best milers, all in preparation in a very Bannister-like way of dissecting what was necessary to win in Helsinki. And then discovers that his training wasn't adequate because they added a semifinal into the 1500 meters contest. So he gets to that final race in the finals, needing him to win because England hasn't yet won a gold, and Bannister finishes fourth. And it is, you know, they crucify him in the press. He's ridiculed on the street. I mean, it was awful. It was as if he had sacrificed England's honor.
He knew going in that the fact that this extra race had been added, he was well aware of the fact that his chances of winning it all were very, very seriously compromised. So I suppose, in effect, his finish did not come as such a devastating surprise to him as it did for onlookers.
Oh, that's very true. I mean, as a friend who saw him from the stands said that he looked as if he was going to the torture chamber when he started that race, because he was psychologically defeated before he even stepped on the track.
How about John Landy?
Well, John Landy's a very different case. I mean, John Landy, what happened to him was that he wasn't even expected to make the 52 Helsinki Olympics. He began training with his coach, Percy Saraty, and improved his times dramatically, and so won a spot, but failed to qualify in both the 1,500 meters and 5,000 meters in Helsinki. And that wasn't as devastating for him as the fact that his coaches and the Australian public were saying he shouldn't even deserve the spot in Helsinki. Not only that, but he and all these other athletes don't train hard enough. They're not focused enough, and they're not determined enough. And this, to John Landy, was, a terrible, terrible thing. And so he came back from Helsinki with the idea that he would never step on the track again unless he was the fittest person there.
Right. He takes great inspiration from Emil Zatopek.
Yes, and I think the other significant event, or the probably most significant event, was that he met Emil Zatopek, the Czech distance runner, who gave him and anyone who was willing to listen his advice, his training advice, which was very good advice about interval training and focus and dedication as far as becoming the best in the world. And it was actually Zatopek at the 52 Helsinki Olympics who, without knowing it probably, spoke to the fact that amateurs who only trained a half hour a day were no longer going to compete against the likes of him, who was training 4 to 5 hours a day every day of the week. And that was a significant breaking point or dividing line at that time, 50 years ago.
It's a tough Olympics for Britain, which does not do very well in the medal count. I think at some point in the book you talk about them having to learn the sour lesson of graciousness in defeat, because they taste that over and over again. On the other hand, Wes Santee is part of an otherwise tremendously successful American team. You say that in not winning a medal, Santee was actually in the minority on his own team, which must have made that especially painful.
Well, particularly because he was the best 1,500 meters runner in the country and didn't get to compete in the 1,500 meters. So he felt like he could have won that event, or at least placed a medal, and never got a shot. So he was, I think, also equally devastated. But of the three, Bannister probably the most. He had the most expectation to win, and he even said the track that disaster is not only your personal expectations being lost, but the public's as well.
Let's jump ahead to the title race of the book, That Perfect Mile, in which Roger Bannister and John Landy are on the same track competing in the mile. First of all, I think we need to clarify the difference between this race and the race where Roger Bannister first broke the 4-minute mile barrier. Explain to us how these two races were so different from each other, and why this second race represented, in some respects, a far greater potential accomplishment.
Well, the breaking of the 4-minute mile on May 6, 1954 was the event that we today, as you know, the world celebrates. It was a human achievement, 4 laps of the track under 4 minutes. But for Roger Bannister, that race wasn't his great achievement, because he ran that race with pacemakers. And although that was perfectly legal and allowed by officials, he knew that on a personal level, that in order to prove that he was the best in the world, he had to win in head-to-head competition. And on May 6th, when he ran with pacemakers, he wasn't able to prove that to himself. So even later that next day, he knew that he wasn't done, that he had always been called a clock runner, and by breaking 4 minutes, he hadn't yet proved that he was anything but that yet.
Mm. On that track, on May 6, 1954, how many runners were there?
There were six other runners, but none of them were even in competition. I mean, it became quite clear from the very beginning when Chris Brasher sat at the lead, Chris Chataway fell behind Bannister, that these three were running a four-minute mile timed race, and the other runners could hardly keep up. I mean, they were so far above and beyond them on performance level.
So they were not meaningful competition for Roger Bannister at all.
That is the point. Correct.
And the best runners on that track who could have been competitors were instead, they were partners
exactly.
to Bannister.
Exactly.
So that is not the case then for the so-called perfect mile. That is a free and clear competition. May the best runner win, whoever that may be.
That's exactly the point, and also the fact that you have two very different runners, Bannister being the pacer, the person who hangs back and likes to deliver a withering finish at the end of a race, versus Landy, who always ran from the front, always wanted to run his competition off their feet, had no interest in tactics whatsoever. He just wanted to blister from the start and to the finish. And so very different styles of runners. They both at this point had broken 4 minutes, and the world wanted to know who was the best. And I think Roger Bannister, more than anybody, wanted to know if he could beat him on head-to-head competition.
50 years later, how do these three athletes view those events of 1954? And I guess I'm curious about Roger Bannister in that he has gone on to accomplish other things in his life. What place does this have in his own sort of personal pantheon? And how about the other two and the disappointment, which I'm sure still is with them all these years later?
Yes, I mean, for Santee and Landy, I mean, there's still a sense of disappointment in not having been the first one through the barrier. Actually, for Landy, I would say it was more losing in Vancouver than not breaking 4 minutes first. I mean, in fact, he had beaten Bannister's time and held the world record for six odd years, so he had a bit of something to hold close to his chest. They, as I say in the book, I mean, they look back at this event with nostalgia and a bit of not this old story again. And those two gentlemen, Landy went on to have a very successful career and is now the governor of Victoria. Santee became a Marine colonel as well as ran a successful insurance business. So they all did okay in life, and they do treasure their running days a great deal. Bannister, I think, of the three, I mean, he became a noted neurologist. He had, as he boasts, 14 grandchildren now. And I think places those events of 1954 probably third, although they're the ones, breaking the four-minute mile gets him the most notoriety and gets his name in the papers and on television. He's most proud of his career as a doctor and his family.
Neil Bascom, the author of a book published 10 years ago on the 50th anniversary of the first four-minute mile. The book, The Perfect Mile, Three Athletes, One Goal, and Less Than 4 Minutes to Achieve It. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Today will be mostly sunny with a high of 28 degrees, a little bit colder out west in Walworth County. Not quite as cold tonight. Light freezing rain is